Case number 09-5167, Melvin Porter, appellant versus Alonzo Flugin, Chief Operating Officer, USAID. Ms. Langford for the appellant, Ms. Lowe for the appellee.
Let's wait till the door's shut. All right.
May it please the court, Ann Langford, on behalf of Appellant Melvin Porter, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. For three distinct reasons that I would like to discuss in turn, Mr. Porter's claims in the district court were prematurely dismissed at the summary judgment stage. First is the district court's ruling that counts 8 and 10 were barred by res judicata. Second was the finding that two negative performance assessments, which were counts 12 and 14 below, do not meet the standard for retaliation. And third was the treatment of Mr. Porter's non-promotion claims, where the district court failed to draw inferences in Mr. Porter's favor and view the evidence as a whole. First, Your Honors, is the issue of res judicata. These claims relate, of course, to the denial of a 2001 performance bonus to Mr. Porter and his receipt of a 2002 needs improvement performance assessment. Both occurred after Mr. Porter prevailed in Porter 1, which was his prior case against his employer, the United States Agency for International Development. And both were notable departures from the status quo in that Mr. Porter had regularly received bonuses and received superlative ratings in the past. Very briefly, in Porter 1, Judge Robertson had granted a general injunction barring the agency from further retaliation. Mr. Porter filed a motion with that court asking that the agency be found in contempt and putting forth the very best evidence that he had available to him at that time. Ultimately, Judge Robertson denied Mr. Porter's request for discovery and issued a cursory denial of Mr. Porter's motion. Then Mr. Porter did what the government in its briefing had suggested that he could, which was that he pursued these instances of retaliation as affirmative claims in the case below. Judge Walton's decision that these claims are now barred is in error.
Can I just be clear?
Yes.
You said in your brief, too, that he proceeded as best he could. What hadn't occurred at that time that he needed? I'm not talking about the discovery, but your brief implied that some event had not happened.
Your Honor, I'm not attempting to imply that there was a particular event, but just that with the information that he had at that time, and it really does go to the discovery issue, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Res judicata prevents the relitigation of claims where a party has already had a full and fair opportunity to litigate them. What does that mean exactly? Through the full course of a litigation, that might mean that a litigant presents claims, certainly develops the facts of his or her case, has the opportunity to recover appropriate relief as well. Mr. Porter got none of that in the post-judgment contempt context. He got no hearing. He had no chance to present testimony or challenge testimony, and he was denied really a litany of procedural protections.
On your full and fair,
yes.
I know in your reply brief you cite the Second Circuit case. Did you cite that also in your main brief in terms of what a full and fair?
Your Honor, no, we did not in the opening brief. And that was really in response to the government's argument that sort of briefing provided Mr. Porter the full aspect, basically briefing his motion provided him everything that he needed in order to have that full and fair opportunity. I think it bears special emphasis that the facts at issue here did not even arise until after the jury verdict occurred in Porter 1. And in Drake versus FAA, this court recognized that, and I'm quoting here, race judicata does not preclude claims based on facts not yet in existence at the time of the original action. That is precisely what happened here, and demonstrates that these claims should have remained in play. In addition, Mr. Porter was denied discovery in Porter 1. Courts have repeatedly recognized, in the employment discrimination context in particular, the importance of discovery. Employment discrimination cases involve extremely issues.
This had been a regular, you had filed a complaint in the district court on this, and the district court had wrongly, inappropriately denied discovery, and then granted summary judgment against you, and you hadn't appealed. You don't doubt that that would be res judicata, do you?
That would be res judicata.
So it's not the fact that you were denied discovery.
It's not the fact alone that we were denied discovery. I think, however, I do think that it's the case that, and particularly I would point your honors to the Gray versus Universal Service Administrative Company case. Discovery would not be denied to a litigant, particularly in an employment discrimination case, when that litigant had stated claims, had survived, for instance, a 12B6 challenge. And
you say the same thing about this case, and you just say that the district court made a mistake. That's what you're saying. The district court should have granted discovery.
This court should have granted discovery, but I think the district court should have granted discovery, absolutely, in Porter 1.
You talk about the performance assessments.
Yes, Your Honor.
About why they constitute adverse actions.
Absolutely. In terms of those, I think the main issue with the performance assessments, and again, those deal with 2003 and 2004 interim assessments that were issued against Mr. Porter, counts 12 and 14 in the case below. These acts fit very comfortably within the test that the Supreme Court laid out in Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railway Company versus White. According to Burlington, retaliation occurs when a reasonable employee would have found the action materially adverse, which in turn the Supreme Court said means that it well might have dissuaded.
I understand the law. It's the facts I'm not getting.
Yes, okay. Mr. Porter had a very long history of stellar ratings, repeated appraisals of excellent and superior. That record changed quite dramatically after Mr. Porter prevailed on his two retaliation claims in Porter 1. And again, that resulted very shortly thereafter in a borderline unacceptable mid-year assessment, 3 months after the Porter 1 jury verdict came down. And in 2004, his supervisor issued the written notice of unacceptable performance, which was placed in Mr. Porter's personnel file. And in addition, he was placed on a performance improvement plan. Respectfully to the district court, it is difficult to imagine how a reasonable employee, particularly one formerly recognized as a high performer, would not have found it materially adverse to receive those kinds of assessments and really that kind of permanent record that did follow him. These, frankly, are not the kind of petty slights and minor annoyances or the simple lack of good manners that the Supreme Court discounted in Burlington. These are very real, and their concrete implications for Mr. Porter were very real as well. This very case is also about Mr. Porter's thwarted efforts after being a GS-14 since 1987 to be promoted to a GS-15 position.
Can I just ask you a question? I understand your argument on the 2004, where it's placed in his personnel record, and at that point he has the performance improvement plan obligation imposed on him. The 2003 is an interim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Evaluation.
That's correct.
And only oral?
Is that right?
And oral.
And only oral, is that what Judge Garland said?
Yes,
Your Honor.
And you argue that was leading to a year-end evaluation whereby then he would be ineligible for a bonus and ineligible for promotion. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The very same misstatements that were included in the 2003 interim evaluation were repeated at the end of the year.
But he's not challenging his 2003 year-end evaluation?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
All right. So is your argument that even, I just need to understand it, because this court has said even a year-end performance evaluation standing alone is not enough to show at least an adverse employment action. And I'm trying to think of a case on retaliation. But your argument is that this, taken in context with everything else that's going on, meets the Burlington Northern test?
The argument first on the 2003 interim appraisal specifically, that did lay the groundwork, one could say, for the 2003 final evaluation, which I think very notably Mr. Porter then challenged, and the government, the U.S. Agency for International Development noted that it was in fact based on erroneous information and falsehoods, and so again that was sort of it laid the groundwork for that.
And it was modified into effective, so he wasn't hurt at the end. Is that right?
The 2003 final evaluation was modified in the end.
So why didn't, is that the reason you're not complaining about the 2003 final? Why aren't you complaining about the two? That's a, I think the question Judge Rogers was asking.
Right.
Why is that?
Mr. Porter, at the time that he brought these, decided, I believe, and I am not positive on this, Your Honor, but I believe that that was working through the process of the challenge. And so he decided as a strategic matter not to challenge that.
Well, if it ends up okay, is there still retaliation, even if the agency as a whole makes sure that it doesn't cause a problem?
Your Honor, I think under Burlington, I think it does. And the reason why I say that is Burlington is very clear in giving several examples of some cases where while there is no, one could say, financial harm or tangible harm, these cases rise to actionable retaliatory conduct. And the examples that the court gave in Burlington were instances such as a change in schedule for a working mother could end up being retaliatory for that person.
That has an immediate effect. Is your view that if a supervisor does something retaliatory and the agency immediately fixes it, say fires the supervisor and gives the employee $100,000, the employee can still sue the agency?
Your Honor, that simply wasn't the case here.
Is the case here is that the bad effect was removed.
Well, the bad effect
on... There was a bad effect. It was removed.
On the 2003 evaluation may have been 2004.
I'm with you. I understand the 2004. That's why I'm focusing first on it. And I think Judge Rogers made the same point. The 2004 is a written one, has
correct.
A PIP with it, et cetera. I'm just wondering about the 2003. I appreciate it's not the key to your case, but still you are raising it. So.
Yes, absolutely. Your Honor, I think with the 2003 evaluation, again, it's an issue that indeed was resolved, and if it's not at that particular moment, if it's fixed automatically, again, I don't necessarily think that would rise to retaliation.
We don't have any written record of the 2003, right?
That's correct. Alone. That's correct.
Okay. Could you go on to the 2004 then?
Yes, and Your Honor, I think in some aspects we've covered that. That ended up being an evaluation. Even the interim evaluation was written, and Mr. Porter was placed on a performance improvement plan. And again, particularly here, where Mr. Porter has been actively seeking GS-15 positions, that had very, very real consequences for him, for his future advancement potential within the agency, for his ability to attain bonuses, And for all of those reasons, that became, again, a part of his permanent record at the agency.
Could I just ask sort of a factual question here? Mrs. Sewell,
yes.
Is she the one? No, Mrs. Turner is the one who was involved in the 2003 and 2004?
Correct, in both of those evaluations.
And what is her position? I mean, what is her job title?
Her title, Your Honor, if I can, I will verify that for you on rebuttal.
I was going through the record and working with my clerk trying to identify who these people are. And I've got Mrs. Lyons, Mrs. Martin, and Mrs. Sewell. And if you look at JA 1602, it says something about Mrs. Turner, but I just want to be sure.
Absolutely. I mean, she was Mr. Porter's supervisor. His supervisor in the Bureau of Policy and Program Coordination.
She's the author of the 2004 interim.
Right? Absolutely, and responsible as well for the 2003 interim.
All right, and so Mrs. Lyons and Mrs. Martin are in the Office of Human Resources, right?
And both, correct, and both.
What I call the personnel office.
And both involved in, right. As responsible actors in the Porter 1 case.
And then Mrs. Sewell was the chief of the personnel operations division?
She and Ms. Sewell was a selecting official in one of the...
No, I understand, on the third job.
On the third job, exactly.
Right, but in other words, she was the chief of the office where they were looking for a deputy. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. Oh, how big, just generally speaking, is this office that Mr. Porter works in? He's in the Bureau for Policy and Program Coordination.
That is correct, Your Honor. I don't have a particular number off the top.
All right. I'm wondering how many times GS-15s come up. I mean, we're dealing with five here. Anyway, all right.
All right. Judge Garland, do you have any more questions? All right. Your time. I'll give you a couple minutes to reply.
Thank you.
Ms. Lowe?
May it please the Court, Michelle Lowe for the United States Agency for International Development. There are a number of issues that have been challenged here today involving seven different employment actions. But when
it would help me if you could focus on the 2004 interim.
I will. The 2004 interim evaluation, as counsel noted, was in fact an interim evaluation. Although there's an allegation that it was placed in his record, the agency's regulations say that the interim regulation are obviously not the final performance evaluation.
But the agency didn't dispute that fact. Is that wrong?
Right. I think it's not placed in the employee's personnel file unless the employee wishes it, and so. I think what must have happened here was the employee must have requested that...
That's not necessarily what happened here at all. All the inferences go in his favor.
Well, being that as it may, even if it was placed in the employee's official personnel file, what the cases in this circuit are very clear that a performance evaluation does not constitute an adverse action unless it's attached to a financial harm.
The language is unless it affects, among other things, affects promotion potential. Right?
That's correct.
So and here it's attached, it includes a PIP, a performance improvement plan, which says if at the end of the PIP you have failed to raise your performance on this work, you will be subject to removal, reduction in grade, reassignment, or withholding of within grade increase. Now that certainly sounds like it could affect promotion, and not only promotion, but job security.
Well, what Mr. Porter identified as the harm in this case, and this was at in the appendix at 971, was that the 2004 interim evaluation foreshadowed the final evaluation.
Right, the argument is that if you get an interim, and in the interim you're told that you're doing so badly that this could cause you to lose your job, that has an effect on promotion. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to lose your job, but it's something that would be considered at the next proceeding.
Well, so
for example, if after today's hearing, we were to tell your supervisor, we won't do this, I promise.
I certainly hope not.
But you did a terrible job here. And the reason I'm saying that is because of, you know, your disability of some kind, and you could prove that. And that goes into your file, and then it doesn't affect you tomorrow or during the interim, but at the end of the year, when your supervisor looks in your file, they say, well, look, the judge said you were terrible in the middle of the year. You got to think that that might have a material impact on your promotion. And in the same way here, it's not a judge, but it's the person's supervisor saying you were really terrible, so terrible that I'm warning you, you could be fired. This is not just, you know, needs improvement. This is, so that's for another day. But for this day, for this case, this is one where it says you could be subject to removal. That seems pretty harsh.
Well, certainly under your hypothetical, and I do hope it's a hypothetical.
It is, I promise. You're doing a great job.
if it could be shown that it was the interim assessment that led to the denial of bonus or the loss of the job, then it would meet the test that this court had set out, that a materially adverse performance evaluation would affect the employee's position, grade level, salary, or promotion opportunities.
Are you saying it has to? I thought our cases talk about promotion potential. Does it have to actually cause it? So you're saying that an interim can never be good enough?
Well, the language is it must affect, and I'm quoting from Taylor v. Solis. Uh-huh. Judge Rogers, you had asked earlier about a case involving retaliation, and I would submit this is such a case.
Well, I know
where
that case very well.
Yes, and so it must affect, the D.C. Circuit has said it must affect the employee's position, grade level, salary, or promotion opportunities.
Opportunity.
Right. The effect here would come from the final 2004 evaluation.
Really? And so if the first one is done by somebody who hates you, the second one is done not by somebody who hates you, and in fact doesn't know anything about that the first person hates you, and the second one isn't done until 6 months later, so it's now too late. Don't have sort of a catch-22 here? You can't complain when the problem really arises, and by the time you can complain, statute of limitations is over.
Well, I think we'd also have to look at what in the Taylor case, we were dealing with final performance evaluations, and the court found the evidence to be insufficient even in that case, even though there had been a lowering of the employee's performance evaluation from outstanding in 2001 to excellent in 2002 and fully effective in 2003.
Right. I got it. I got that. And that's certainly, you see a difference between a performance evaluation of fully effective and one that says you're going to be fired if you don't improve.
Well,
those are pretty different.
Well, there must be an opportunity for the employer to give you feedback and give you an opportunity to improve. Now, if you can show, it may be the case that the final evaluation may have led to denial of promotion or opportunities, but there hasn't been any evidence that it was the 2004 interim evaluation that led to the denial of promotional opportunities. Mr. Porter hasn't adduced any evidence of that.
You think interim evaluations just don't mean anything? I mean, imagine every single year, for 5 years, you get, and not you personally, employee gets a awful interim, but in the final doesn't lose their job. And then 5 years later, the supervisor says, look, well, for 5 years, for some reason, every June the person's terrible, and brings it up at the end of the year. Well, we can't have that. We can't have somebody who's terrible for 6 months and good for 6 months. You have to wait until that, you know, till the clock finally strikes before you can feel retaliated against?
That would certainly be an anomalous situation if the final for five consecutive years didn't say you were terrible. And
well, here you're saying in 2003 there was an interim one. 2004, which was fixed at the end of 2003, and there was a 2004, We don't even know whether the 2004 was fixed or not, right?
Well, there was a 2004 final evaluation, which I do believe is being challenged in a separate proceeding. And that one we would submit if plaintiff or Mr. Porter can show that it led to the loss of promotional opportunities or other tangible financial harm, that would be the
So is the government's position that interim appraisals just don't never affect promotional opportunities?
I think the position is that if the employee is able to show that it was the interim evaluation that led to directly to the loss of a promotional opportunity, then there may be, that may be a situation where that constitutes a materially adverse effect. It's not enough to say that the interim 2004 evaluation foreshadowed the 2004 final evaluation.
Why? Because a reasonable person wouldn't be dissuaded from, that's a test set out in Burlington, right? It has to be, would a reasonable person be dissuaded from complaining by the action of the agency?
That's right.
So if you know that if you complain, you're going to get an awful midterm evaluation, not just meets expectations, but you're going to be fired, that's not enough to dissuade a reasonable person?
Well, there's a...
As a matter of law?
There's a material adversity component to it.
That's the definition of material adversity, right?
Well, and...
Am I right? The definition in Burlington of what material adversity means is, would a reasonable person be dissuaded from complaining if that's what happened to them?
Well, and how this court has construed that test is to say that it must, for performance evaluation specifically, to be materially adverse, it must have an effect on the potential
promotional opportunities. Right.
And so I think a reasonable employee would understand that an interim evaluation does not have that effect. And that's
I must say for myself, I was a government employee, and I would certainly have felt that at mid-year, if I got it, you're going to be fired if you don't improve, that would mean I would not become supervisor of the civil division or the criminal division or any other division. I mean,
this is serious stuff.
This is serious, and people usually get pretty good reviews if they're going to move up. And if you get bad reviews, I'm with you on the point of, you know, minor object, you know, problems, but when somebody is threatened with being fired, it certainly makes it pretty hard to move up after that.
Well, I want to first make a small point that the PIP itself was mentioned just in the opening brief very summarily, and
he hasn't waived it.
And well,
I mean, that's not a waiver. He's challenged it. It's part of the 2004. I mean, I don't think the government's going to get anywhere on that.
I don't doubt that it is a serious matter to have an interim evaluation, but the fact is you have to see this 2004 evaluation interim was the same as a 2003 interim evaluation. It just gives you an opportunity, gives
Except
the employee.
It's in writing. It's in his personnel file. It includes a PIP.
Was there a PIP with the 2003?
No. No, it was an oral interim evaluation.
Let me ask you on summary judgment, too. Given the mosaic that the plaintiff has presented, is it your position that because these are not final performance evaluations, that they cannot give rise to the inferences that the plaintiff is asserting here?
I think it's our position that because these were interim evaluations that did not have an effect on the plaintiff's promotional opportunities.
Here's a man who has had excellent and outstanding ratings all these years. Then he files a lawsuit. And he wins on 2 of 6 counts, right? And the very person who was found to have retaliated unlawfully against him, when a GS-15 next comes up, and this is while that lawsuit is pending, rewrites the job description, refuses to interview anybody including the plaintiff, who's, what is it, non-status, that's a word of art. Then when the next GS-15 becomes available, the same person does a lateral transfer and doesn't announce it in advance. Then the third GS-15 comes up, and the agency puts out an announcement saying it wants a college graduate and it would like some master's degrees. And it just ignores that. Then, 2003, get this interim negative appraisal. Then 2004, it's in the personnel file and there's a PIP plan. Now that's a mosaic for summary judgment. And why doesn't that all fit into the inferences to which the plaintiff is entitled on summary judgment?
It doesn't all fit because these are all separate acts involving separate actors.
This is one employee. These are all events that have happened to him in one agency over a relatively short period of time.
Well, taking
it's not a mosaic, it's his career.
Taking each of those in turn, Your Honor.
I know. And you know, I've cited Supreme Court cases talking about how we're supposed to view these cases in their totality, these incidents. We don't pick them apart one by one.
They involve different actors, each of them.
I know, but this is one human being in an agency, and this whole series of events have occurred. And you want to pick them apart and say, well, the fact that now for the first time, you know, he gets a negative interim performance evaluation, you know, there's no, under the Burlington standard, there's no evidence, no inference of retaliation here. And then he gets a 2004. Remember, this is summary judgment.
Well,
he may not win, but we're at summary judgment.
Well, we are at summary judgment, and even taking all those inferences in the plaintiff's favor, the district court properly found that summary judgment was proper because
we're de novo.
That's true. We do have different individuals involved in each of these.
Well, we have Mrs. Martin.
We have Ms. Martin
in four of them directly.
No,
in the two Porter cases, and in the first job, and in the lateral transfer. That's Mrs. Martin.
Actually, Your Honor, it was Ms. Lyons who made the decision in the lateral transfer, not Ms. Martin.
All right. Well, she's one of the people in Porter 1 who was found to have retaliated.
Well,
Lyons and Martin.
And she did make a decision. Ms. Lyon made a decision that a lateral transfer was proper. It's certainly permissible under agency regulations to do that. You had a GS-15.
No, but I'm looking at a mosaic of a person. That's why. How big is this bureau that the plaintiff is in? Do you have any idea?
I don't actually know, Your Honor.
Is it a big bureau or is it a small bureau? I mean, how many GS-15s are there?
I don't actually know the answer to that, but
what we know is there were at least five because he applied for them, he would have applied except for the lateral transfer that was not announced.
It was not announced, but that's a permissible employment practice to decide to laterally transfer an individual.
But all I'm getting at is then you get a 2003 performance evaluation that is based on knowingly false information that the agency has to correct. I mean, this mosaic is not a pretty one.
Well, what we also have, Your Honor, is that there was a reorganization, and in 2002 or 2003, sometime around then, Mr. Porter had received a new supervisor, who was Ms. Turner, and she became his supervisor. But
she's the one who's putting false information in the evaluation. I mean, that doesn't speak highly for the agency. The agency decided she was putting knowingly false information in the evaluation.
Well, I think the agency corrected or gave him a different evaluation at year-end in 2003.
She acknowledged that she was putting false information in. I mean, that's extraordinary.
If I may briefly address the res judicata point, if the court would find that useful.
All right, go ahead. Briefly.
I think what, as we stated, Mr. Porter had an opportunity to fully litigate this issue, and the test for res judicata is whether the claims could have been raised or were raised in a prior litigation.
How do you distinguish the Second Circuit case?
Well, Mr. Porter...
Marvel characters.
Well, Mr. Porter...
Different standard of proof, different remedy.
That, again, was raised for the first time in the...
reply brief,
and it ought to be foreclosed.
What full and fair opportunity means, because the government said he had a full and fair opportunity because he got to brief. And he's responding by saying, yeah, but the standard was very different on a post-judgment motion. I couldn't have gotten the same remedy.
He has said throughout that full and fair would have entitled him to full discovery, and or below he said full and fair means a right to a jury trial, which is certainly not the case. You have to make a showing that you're entitled to a jury trial in the first place. Now, in terms of different remedies, Mr. Porter knew that at the time that he brought post-trial contempt proceedings. This post-trial contempt proceedings were brought in July 2003. The issues, the 2001 bonus, 2002 performance evaluation were fully ripe at the time. And he certainly could have brought it in a district court litigation. He chose to bring it in post-trial contempt proceedings.
Because he obtained an injunction against the agency, so he wouldn't have to spend tons of money bringing a totally new lawsuit. He could just go back to court and file a motion for contempt.
And that's what he did.
Right.
He filed a motion for an order to show cause. Judge Robertson granted the order to show cause, but upon reviewing the submissions, which fully briefed the retaliation issue, Judge Robertson discharged the order to show cause.
So having chosen to proceed in that manner, he has no basis to make the sort of melody argument that the Second Circuit...
We believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just pause for one second? Did you acknowledge? I'm sure I just missed this. That Turner had knowingly put false information into the file.
I don't believe. If we are to construe all the facts favorably in the plaintiff's favor, I don't believe that the evidence.
I thought it was in the record that she acknowledged that she knew that information was false, but she put it in anyway. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's in the plaintiff's statement of facts.
I just didn't remember. I'm not saying one way or the other. I just didn't remember. It's not in the appraisal. It's not in the appraisal committee's report.
Right.
All they said is that they, they're changing it. They think deserved another look, and they've changed it. But I didn't see the. I'm not saying it didn't happen. Maybe opposing counsel will be able to answer that.
Right. Well, I do believe it was a statement plaintiff had put in his statement of the facts. But
okay.
Thank you.
I want to be clear. My hypothetical was not about you.
Thank you. I'm glad that's on the record.
Very good job.
Thanks for having time, Liv. All right. Why don't you take 1 minute?
Your Honors, I think the inferences issue came up loud and clear just now, and whether we call it a mosaic or a pattern, viewing all of the issues that Mr. Porter raised together as a whole, I think absolutely the district court did not give him the deference, those facts, the deference that he deserved. I think the Deputy Chief Personnel Operations Division position and all of the irregularities that were inherent in that came up. And I would like to point your honors particularly to page 1499 of the appendix, which is not page 1494 as our opening brief states, but I mean the position description for that. I think this is emblematic of things that were occurring. On 1499, we have the educational requirements for that position. It calls for a BA/BS in personnel management, business administration, or international business management. That's required. An MA/MS is desired. What happened here? Mr. Porter had 2 advanced degrees in that area. And for a GS-15 position in the government, the selected employee had a high school degree. That it's truly extraordinary. And again, it's these kinds of facts over and over again. When you aggregate them and add them together and don't pick them apart and sort of atomize it.
Do I have any questions? Because we're way over time.
Can you clarify the question that Judge, not clarify the question, but the answer to Judge Garland's question?
Is that, was regarding?
About Mrs. Turner. Is it Mrs. Taylor or Mrs. Turner?
Barbara Turner.
Mrs. Turner, who was involved with the performance evaluation for 2003.
Yes, and 2004.
And did she say, I have what I think is the page. I can't derive that from this. Are you taking her as saying that I intentionally put false information into the appraisal?
I take it that she knew that a particular employee, and again, I believe this comes from deposition testimony, that she knew that an employee had some knowledge, and then yes, had adopted that into the performance
appraisal.
I
think we're referring to is JA 1580. Unfortunately, there's a page missing here. So we have page 321 of the transcript, and the question, this is about Ms. Turner talking about, did you use Ms. Levinson's feedback? And the question at the bottom of the page is, and were you satisfied with the validity and accuracy of all the things she said in this email? And the answer is no. But what we don't have is page 322, which would say, I used it anyway. We don't have any, all she's saying is I wasn't satisfied. I would hope she said, and I didn't use it all. But I don't actually know what she said. Do we know any more?
Your Honor, I was not involved at this stage of the pre-proceedings. I don't know. If the court is interested, we could arrange to get that missing page.
You're not making the argument now that that Turner intentionally put something false in. That is, that she acknowledged. I'm sorry, you are making that argument. You're not arguing that she acknowledged that she had done that.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me ask one more question, if I could. This is on the race judicata question on whether the standard was different in the injunction. As I read Judge Robertson's order, his standard was actually better for your client rather than worse. That is, in his memorandum order, he says, retaliation in violation of this court's injunction can occur without an employment action that would be recognized as adverse in Title VII. The injunction is directed to the agency and its director, who must take steps to ensure that no retaliatory action is taken. That is, even if it's not sufficiently adverse for Title VII. And then his next sentence says, that said, I find no evidence in the record before me. So that sounds like you're actually getting a better standard of review than you would if it was Title VII, not a worse standard.
Your Honor, again, I think that order was extremely dismissive in that it only adopted, I believe it cited 2 facts. Again, if I'm thinking of the same order, I don't have it right in front of me at the moment. But again, we're dealing with an issue here where he adopted facts only that the government had raised, absolutely dismissed.
We have lots of cases where that's what the plaintiff says about what the district court did, and I'm sure when we're finished here, you may well say that about what we say on some points, but that doesn't make it not res judicata. He does say that the standard he's applying is in your favor, not against you. That is, it's better than you would have gotten if you'd been in a civil court, in a civil complaint. Right? In a civil complaint, you have to show a materially adverse action for retaliation. He's saying you don't have to do that because this is an injunction case. I don't want any kind of retaliation here.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that affects the fact that then Mr. Porter would be barred for other procedural issues that were here.
What other procedure? I mean,
discovery lacking.
But discovery, we don't know what the standard for. We know you were denied it. We don't know you wouldn't be denied it wrongly somewhere else. But what else?
So we have discovery lacking. I mean, he didn't. While the government makes much of the fact that this was fully briefed, he never actually pled those claims before. Under the standard of federal rule of civil procedure 7, there was no. I mean, that contemplates some very narrow things that a pleading can be: a complaint, an answer, and in certain court-ordered circumstances, a reply.
Res judicata applies even in administrative law. That is, if an administrative agency decides against you, and we can only review for substantial evidence, we're still stuck with res judicata if that's the route you started with.
But I think what we need to be comparing here is what he got in the post-judgment contempt proceedings and what he would have had he had a chance to bring that affirmatively.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we're going to take a short break.